You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Last year, Michael Wolff's book, Fire and Fury, skyrocketed to number one on the New York Times bestseller list, with its account of palace intrigues inside the Trump administration and shocking details of the president's pettiness, lack of ethics, and at times, outright hapless buffoonery. Now Michael Wolff follows it up with his latest book, Siege, Trump Under Fire, an equally explosive book about the presidency that is under attack from almost every side. Beginning just as Trump's second year as president is getting underway and ending with the delivery of the Mueller report, Siege reveals an administration that is perpetually beleaguered by investigations and a president who is increasingly volatile, erratic, and exposed. And today, Michael Wolff joins me on the podcast to talk about the book and how he got so many of his original sources to talk to him again, even after President Trump threatened to prosecute leakers. We talk about how Robert Mueller carefully strategized and gamed out every step of the Russia probe, how his team delicately avoided provoking Trump into shutting down the investigation, and whether or not Mueller may have actually drafted an indictment of Donald Trump. He shares how Jared Kushner's suspicious dealings with shady foreign investors jeopardized his White House security clearance, how he sought the counsel of Henry Kissinger in his effort to install himself as Secretary of State, and how Jared and Ivanka see the current administration as their own stepping stone to the presidency. Michael offers juicy insights into Trump's troubled history with women, how Trump's own boasting, true or not, led to rumors of an affair in the White House, and how Trump's inner circle lives in constant fear of the day when the Me Too movement will inevitably catch up to the president. He sheds some light on Donald and Melania's marriage of convenience, Melania's mysterious week-long hospital stay, and rumors of security camera footage of Donald striking his wife in a hotel elevator. He reveals how Senator Mitch McConnell got the upper hand on the president, why Steve Bannon still holds out hope that Trump will bring him back into the fold, and the real reason Nikki Haley resigned as ambassador to the UN. Plus, how Trump started a family feud at Fox News, more evidence that Trump is just plain batshit crazy, and I ask him the question burning on everyone's mind, why is Donald Trump just so damn weird? Coming up with Michael Wolff in just a moment. Michael Wolff is the author of Fire and Fury, the number one bestseller that for the first time told the inside story of the Trump White House. He's received numerous awards for his work, including 2 National Magazine Awards. The author of 7 previous books, he's been a regular columnist for Vanity Fair, New York, The Hollywood Reporter, British GQ, and other magazines and newspapers. Now he's following up his bestseller Fire and Fury with an equally revealing portrait of Trump's second year in office. It's titled Siege, Trump Under Fire. Michael Wolff, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Michael, I think you say that you have 150 sources for Siege. How many of those were repeat customers from Fire and Fury?
Yeah, many were. I mean, that's really the origin of this second book, is that after the first book, everybody kept speaking to me. So it was a natural segue. The story went on, and the people talking about the story continued to talk. So here I am.
Let me ask you this, Michael. How did you get so many of these Trump insiders to talk again, especially after Trump threatened to prosecute any leakers? Aren't they afraid?
Well, you know, most of the people who have spoken to me actually are out of the White House now. In fact, most of the people who, the White House is practically speaking empty now. So the first wave of Trump insiders was left the White House, and now the second wave of Trump insiders has left the White House. So which leaves everybody free to talk and to talk and frankly. To talk. So, I mean, I think one of the things about being associated with this White House is that you remain not only wrapped up in the story, but ever trying to understand the story.
One of the people who participated in both books and has been pretty open about it was Steve Bannon. He plays really an outsized role in this book and seems to have as good of an understanding of how things work in the Trump White House as anyone. What's your relationship with Steve Bannon like?
Well, we have a good relationship, and we've spent a lot of time talking about this subject. I mean, I think Steve spends all of his time talking about this subject. And, you know, of all of the people who have been around Trump, associated with Trump over the last 3 years, I continue to find Steve Bannon certainly among the most insightful people, and in a way the most among the bravest, because he's certainly willing to put his name to what he says.
Yeah, and it's interesting that a guy who's been outside of the Trump administration for, what, something around a year now, of all the people, he seems to have probably a more accurate sense of what's going on and who Trump is than probably anyone who's still in Trump's inner circle. Why does he have such access? How does he know these things?
Well, I think to be outside, it's a weird kind of outsideness. Because both Trump and Bannon remain focused on each other. Bannon has considerable clout within the White House because he carries the ideological flags. So the real pillars of Trumpism, the immigration initiatives, the China issue, this is all Steve Bannon. I mean, it's somewhat Trump too, but Trump is prone to wandering off topic here, and Bannon is one of the people pulling the levers who keeps him resolutely on topic.
Yeah, there seem to be a number of people on the outside who maintain their ties to the White House, in some cases in spite of having left on bad terms. Is it a little bit like The Godfather? You know, just when you think you're out, they pull you back in.
I think it's partly that, and then I think it's partly this kind of codependence. Nobody exists without the White House. This is, you know, certainly Bannon, as a prime example, has become a significant voice in the world because of Donald Trump. As strangely, Donald Trump doesn't exist without those people either. And again, to Bannon, Donald Trump becomes the president of the United States because of Steve Bannon. There's really no other. Steve really remains the crucial piece of the puzzle there. And so they go back and forth. They love each other. They hate each other. They're attracted to each other. They're repelled by each other. It's a totally fascinating and pretty naked personal drama.
You have some interesting insights into the Trump-Bannon relationship. In fact, you say Trump's misfortune has always been Bannon's opportunity. Can you give some examples of that?
Well, I think, you know, Bannon went into the campaign in August 2016. Trump was down by you know, 15 to 20 points down. You know, the campaign was basically on life support, if that. The Republican Party was about to cut the campaign loose. Bannon came in, righted the ship, had a strategy for how they could thread the needle and in fact win, and that's what happened. And right now, I would say that it is on both of their minds whether Bannon becomes involved with the 2020 campaign. Now that's hardly simple because Trump can barely abide the idea that he might again be in the position where people go around and say he owes his presidency to Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon can barely abide the possibility of having to work again for Donald Trump, a man among for all other beyond all other issues, a man who is extremely unpleasant to work for.
Bannon's hardly the only person around the president who has an agenda. Parts of this book read a lot like Game of Thrones. Another one of these people is Mitch McConnell. How did he manipulate the midterm elections to give him maximum leverage over the president?
Well, well more than a year ago, McConnell started to say to people that the House was lost and they should and this is basically to donors, they should write off the House race and put all their money into the Senate. If they could hold the Senate, they would hold the Senate, especially if they had the resources. And that's what happened. And that, you know, in a pretty particular way makes Mitch McConnell the kingmaker. The president of the United States exists now because the Senate is his bulwark against impeachment and the investigations in the House of Representatives. That means Mitch McConnell is basically the man in the catbird seat.
Now, I have to ask about the key event of this second year in the Trump presidency, the Mueller investigation. You describe Mueller as sort of a Hamlet figure whose fatal flaw may have been that he's too careful or too fair. Can you expand on that?
Steve Bannon in the book at one point says, this is after the Mueller report comes out, he says, never send a Marine to do a hitman's job. And I think what that means is that in the ultimate analysis, Robert Mueller, who many anti-Trump people had vested a kind of hero's aura around, turned out to be a man much more interested in protecting the institutions. And my own theory here, I have a set of documents which shed some light on what was going on in the Mueller investigation over the last 2 years. But my own theory in reading these documents is that Mueller made the decision that he stood between a president who, if he confronted him directly, would provoke the mother of all constitutional crises. And so I think he proceeded a set of halfway measures or a significantly more unconfrontational manner. And in the end, they produced a report which is damning to the president, but in fact, at least at this point, seems to let the president survive. You know, I've run through this in my mind, thinking what would happen if it were someone else, and I kind of played the scenario out. What would happen if, in a kind of parallel universe, it had been somebody like Rudy Giuliani, who was the special prosecutor. And in that instance, I would say certainly a Rudy Giuliani type would have indicted that son of a bitch.
Well, since you brought him up, when Trump brought Giuliani on his legal team, you say that everyone in the administration thought that he was drunk or he had dementia or he was nuts every time he went on Fox News.
Including the president, yeah, who would often point out that Rudy is losing it.
Yeah. But you also say that his craziness worked from a PR standpoint. Is Rudy crazy or is he crazy like a fox?
It, you know, I think that's the question about many people in this administration. And I tend to think they're just crazy. But just because you're just crazy doesn't mean that craziness can't work for you. And I think that was one of the other things about Mueller and how he responded to this. Mueller is a conventional guy. He's a straight shooter. It's all he plays by the book, and suddenly you're confronted with these guys who respond in completely unconventional ways, crazy ways. It's an asymmetry that I think profoundly confuses anybody who's used to working within the guidelines of the established process.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've made the claim in this book that Mueller had a draft indictment drawn up against Trump for obstruction. Recently, a Mueller spokesperson put out a statement saying that your characterization was inaccurate. Do you still stand by that?
Well, yeah. Well, let me say the Mueller people said I think their exact statement was the documents as described do not exist. So to me, that's an old-fashioned non-denial denial. And so I've gone around trying to precisely explain the thing that I have, which demonstrably exists because it's in my hands, but what I have is a 56-page memorandum, and it assumes that the president has been indicted, and further assumes that that the president has gone into court and asked for that indictment to be dismissed on the grounds that you can't indict a sitting president. Mm. The document, the 56-page document I have, is in response to the president's motion, and it's comprised of two parts. The first part of about 20 pages recaps all of the specifics of a three-count indictment, and that's what I refer to as the draft indictment. The second part of this memorandum is a very powerful argument about why the special counsel can, in fact, indict a sitting president.
And one thing that you say is that Mueller was constantly strategizing and trying to prepare for all possible outcomes, which can be sort of hard since the president is just so erratic. Is it possible that this was just an option he wanted to keep in his pocket if worst came to worst, or do you think he seriously was weighing it?
I'm sure it was. Obviously, he was not. They did not indict the president. So, the Mueller investigation, which has run for 2 years, and happened within this incredible cone of silence. So we don't know what happened there, but it did go on for 2 years. So something must have happened, and I think it would be pretty much inconceivable that they did not consider the terms of a possible indictment and did not debate their in fact right to indict the president. So first thing, my source is impeccable here, and I'm going to absolutely stand by the fact that what I'm offering here is a window, in a way, the first window into what was going on behind those doors for the past 2 years.
This also seems indicative of the kind of gamesmanship that went into the Mueller investigation, from how could they possibly keep the investigation going without provoking Trump to shut it down, to weighing whether they should ask Brett Kavanaugh to recuse himself if an indictment went to the Supreme Court. It seems like the Mueller team had to always be one step ahead of the president.
Well, I think one of the things that I also have, I have a set of research documents, and these documents are all about the vulnerabilities of the special counsel's office. And the conclusion when you read these documents, and they really ask a set of very specific questions: can the president himself fire the special counsel? Answer: yes. What happens to the work product if the investigation is closed down? Answer: no one knows, but it is quite possible that all of the work product could be shredded. It goes on with these kinds of questions, and what you learn after reading this substantial research is that the special counsel is really a very fragile construct. They could have been closed down at any point, at any time. And I think one of their goals became not just to pursue a case against the president, but as much not to be shut down, not to provoke that constitutional crisis along the way.
And I mentioned that the Mueller team was thinking so far ahead that they were considering whether to ask Brett Kavanaugh to recuse himself if this went to the Supreme Court. And I want to ask you about Kavanaugh. Did Trump's estimation of his Supreme Court nominee wane as the confirmation hearings drug on?
There's a lot in this book that's actually quite funny. It's sort of gallows humor, yeah. But it's funny. And there's a scene not long after Kavanaugh is nominated that somebody, and several people have speculated that it was probably Trump's sister, a retired federal judge. So this person tells Trump that there are no Protestants on the Supreme Court. And this is dumbfounding to the president. And then he suddenly gets the idea that Brett Kavanaugh is part of a Catholic cabal to pack the court and then overrule Roe v. Wade. Now, this is all kind of screwy because, remember, Trump is theoretically an anti-abortion president. Of course, many years in the years before he ran for president, he was quite pro-abortion. So at this moment, it suddenly found him coming back to that point of view, and then everybody has to rush in and kind of remind him of what his position is. And then during the Kavanaugh the controversy in which Kavanaugh was trying to defend himself, and Trump felt that he was doing a terrible job and was coming off as quite a weakling, then Trump got on the phone to people and said that he thought Kavanaugh was probably abused by a priest. As I say, this is gallows humor.
Yeah. I want to ask about some of the other players who are still in Trump's circle, particularly the vice president. Does Donald Trump respect him at all?
No. I mean, he's constantly saying strange things about the vice president, like wondering why he looks at him like the way he looks at him, and calling him a religious nut. And this sort of follows a Trump pattern. You know, when people pay him, you know, seem like sycophants around him, he nearly always expresses his contempt for them. And there's a lot of people have speculated that he doesn't like the vice president because he somehow sees the vice president as plotting against him or waiting for his downfall to step up. But I think the real reason goes to this fact that he fundamentally feels the vice president is again a kind of a weakling.
And even though you say that Mike Pence might not be plotting against him, it sounds like his wife, Karen Pence, has been quietly strategizing behind the scenes.
Well, you know, in the White House, Mrs. Pence is called mother by everyone. not said with affection. So she's kind of regarded as the power behind the vice presidential throne, as it were. And about her too, I think Trump at one point says that she, you know, she gives me the creeps. And she was behind the plotting when Trump nominated the White House doctor Ronnie Jackson to be the head of Veterans Affairs. And that was a weird White House story because he had been the doctor in the White House, and then Mrs. Pence had gone to see him for a gynecological problem, and then Dr. Jackson sort of gossiped about this, and that got back to Mrs. Pence, the mother, and she really led the campaign to derail his nomination to the head of Veterans Affairs.
And Trump's reaction to Pence's slavish devotion to him is a good example of how Trump demands total servitude from his inner circle, and then once he gets it, he seems to become repulsed by their spinelessness. And Bannon actually gets sort of philosophical on this point and has an interesting theory that I think probably says more about Trump than anything. Do you know what I'm talking about? Could you explain that?
Yeah. I mean, he says, you know, basically says that Trump hates himself so much that he sees immediately through anybody who is sycophantic and slavish toward him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so basically he has no respect for anyone who can't see through him.
Yeah, no, there's kind of a funny bit about Sean Hannity, who is a key person in this White House, spends an enormous amount of time talking to Trump. But yet here again, you know, then Trump starts to badmouth Hannity because he's giving him too much attention.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about Hannity and Fox News. To what degree do you think Trump has damaged the Fox brand and might have even been the reason for some of the rumors of a rift between Rupert Murdoch and his sons?
I think it's a really interesting thing that's happened there. Roger Ailes, used the former head of the founder and former head of Fox News, would always caution against giving even a Republican president the ability to call the shots at the network. The network, he was always very clear, the network was calling the shots. The Republican president, a Republican president, could fall in behind Fox, but not the other way around. And that's that's really what's happened here. I mean, after Ailes left, after Trump was elected, you suddenly have a network where Trump is literally calling the shots. He is the not too subtle way, he's communicating directly with the Fox control booth.
Wow. Now, one of the marvels of this administration is how much diplomatic heavy lifting has been given to, of all people, Jared Kushner, who came to this job with no foreign policy experience. Does Jared see himself as a future Secretary of State?
Yeah, well, he and his father-in-law have discussed that on at least several occasions, if not more.
Really?
And it's extraordinary. I mean, essentially, Jared Kushner is involved on a daily basis talking to and negotiating with people in parts of the world, particularly the Middle East, who he no doubt counts on and will in the future return to finance his businesses. They already are financing his businesses. I mean, I can't think of an example a more overt example of a compromised government than this.
And do you think that it's his financial dealings that kept him from getting a security clearance?
I think that there's a lot of things. One of the things stories I recount in the book is that Kushner was investigated because he was accused of breaking and entering someone's apartment. And this is a kind of a Baroque story. You know, Kushner has a kind of lieutenant, the guy who ran his newspaper in New York, who had a very bad marital breakup, and his wife gave some information about this breakup to her best friend, who was a doctor at Mount Sinai Hospital. And in better times, Jared's friends had gotten Jared to get this woman an apartment in one of the Trump buildings. And she later accused Jared of using a pass key to come into her apartment to look for this incriminating information that might be in her possession.
Does the Kushner company come close to rivaling the Trump organization for murky foreign investors?
Yeah, of course. And it's not exceptional. They're both sort of, C-level real estate companies, and they all depend, both the Trump organization and the Kushner companies, they depend on their ability to get financings. And financings, it's often hard. I mean, often you have to go from, you start wanting blue chip financings, and then you start to go down the road, and you find yourself in the Middle East.
Hmm. And it's interesting that he seems to see himself as Secretary of State, because these delusions of grandeur seem to be common among people in Trump's inner circle. You say that Michael Cohen thought he was going to be Chief of Staff. Bannon thinks he could run for president himself. It's as if Trump broke the seal when he, however improbably, got elected to office, for which he was wholly unqualified. And he's inspired all of the people around him to aspire to positions way above their pay grade.
Yeah, I think that's a very smart way of looking at this. And also, the greater context is that none of these people have any experience in politics or government. Therefore, having made this extraordinary leap, I guess you assume you can keep making extraordinary leaps.
Now, one of the few people who's managed to make a graceful exit from the Trump administration and do so on her own terms was Nikki Haley. But you say that her departure was a deliberate slap in the face to Trump. What was the real reason for her exit?
Well, I don't, she departed, as I think, 23 days before the midterm election. It was a very public departure. Basically, it was a condition of a situation which the senior-most woman in the administration was leaving just before the midterm elections. And in fact, she wasn't leaving before the midterm elections. She was planning to stay until January. So why couldn't she have left, announced her departure a day after the elections? So this was a very theatrical moment in which she established her independence from Donald Trump. And she has become, in many ways, she's the last best hope of the Republican Party, or of the leadership of the traditional Republican Party. Mm-hmm. As we've seen, women in virtually all college-educated women and many other women depart the Republican Party. She's the one person who, certainly on a demographic basis, you might say can begin to rebuild the Republican Party's the trust of women in the Republican Party.
And in this new book, Siege, you actually expand on a theory that you had hinted at last time around, which is the possibility of an affair between Nikki Haley and Trump. Do you think that was real, or was it just his imagination?
You know, I got into trouble with Fire and Fury. That was not in Fire and Fury, but in the commentary,
right, in the conversation
after this. I had heard Trump telling many people that he and Nikki Haley, the ambassador to the United Nations, were involved in a sexual relationship. During this book, I paid significantly more attention to this and kind of tracked down, I think, what happened. It was one of those instances of which I think my instinct, the president of the United States says something to a lot of people. He's the president of the United States. You believe it.
Sure.
And I kind of work that back, and you realize, why would you believe this? And many of the people who he had told this, when I went back to them and I said, okay, what about this? He's saying Nikki Haley and perform this particular sex act on him. And I said, you know, what do you think? And they said, oh no, he says this about everybody. This is how he treats women. This is when he says locker room talk, that doesn't really mean that he's telling you the truth. In fact, actually, in most instances, Trump doesn't tell the truth about anything. But particularly this, he is always talking about women, what he wants them to do to him, what he says they have done to him. I think the conclusion is very clear here. You know, Trump's default is always to demean women, and that has no relationship to the reality of what might actually have happened.
Yeah.
It is just the one way, the only way he knows how to see women.
On the subject of Trump's improprieties with women, what does the Trump White House make of the whole Me Too movement? I mean, somehow Trump seems to be the one person who hasn't been held to account for his behavior. Do you think that still could be his eventual undoing?
You know, certainly, it's a thing. You never bring up Me Too in the White House. You
really?
Never, ever, ever bring it up. Steve Bannon certainly thinks that it is one of those bullets of the many bullets out there that are aimed at Trump that might actually one day hit him. And Bannon was one of the key figures in after the Hollywood Access, you know, grab them by the pussy tape. Mm-hmm. There were a set of women, I think 25 women who came out and said that Trump had harassed or even attacked them. And Bannon said, you know, they were lucky. They were able to sort of mash all. There were so many that everybody lost track of who was whom. But Bannon's point is that was in a different climate. And we're in a new climate now, and it is very possible that those women will be back, and they will have and their stories will be not mashed together, but singular and clarion.
Mm-hmm. Well, what can you tell us about the most important woman, or I guess maybe one of the two most important women in his life, Melania? Is there something between them, or is this just a marriage of convenience or an arrangement of sorts?
One of the people in the White House and the people around him, when you ask them about this, and this is not a subject that anyone particularly wants to talk about, for obvious reasons, but they almost all say they have never seen a marriage. And they talk about it as a Tom Cruise, Katie Holmes deal. Melania doesn't really live in the White House. She really lives with her son and her parents in a house in Maryland. A lot of people have described having to turn away from how Trump treats his son, and that apparently is a major cause of distress in their marriage. He doesn't like his youngest son. Actually, other people go on to say he doesn't like any of his sons. He treats them all badly. But I think that this has been a particularly, to say the least, hard issue for his wife at this point.
There was all kind of speculation when Melania was hospitalized for a week at Walter Reed. Do you have any idea what was going on there?
I write about it, and I try to get to the bottom of it, but I don't. I just know that nobody, 100%, thinks that that the story on its face is true.
I guess there are rumors of security footage of Trump beating Melania in a Los Angeles hotel elevator. What do we know about that?
Nobody knows if this exists, but nevertheless, the people around him, first thing, they don't at all discount that it might exist. And then they speculate when it might have happened. And part of the speculation is that it happened at after a visit to a lawyer in Los Angeles when they were discussing renegotiating their prenup.
I mean, that's some pretty unhinged stuff, if that's true.
I think the whole message of this book certainly is that we are operating at the very least on the edge of the unhinged every day.
You say that a dozen different staffers have expressed something along the lines of, "I've never met anyone as crazy as Donald Trump." So why do they work for him still?
Well, I can even push that further. I think that almost everybody who has been in some kind of close contact with him over the last 3 years believes that there is something fundamentally wrong here. Wrong with not just the situation, but wrong with him.
Most
of them no longer work for him. The first wave of staffers, almost all of them left. The second wave of staffers, almost all of them left. The remaining people, junior staffers have been promoted to senior staffers. And in some sense, the only people who of significance who yet remain are Jared Kushner and his daughter Ivanka. I think you can kind of analyze that people. He's the president of the United States, and so at least in the beginning, people went to work for him because he is the president of the United States. At this point in time, I think it's very hard for him to get anyone to come in work with him in close proximity. They had Mick Mulvaney is the chief of staff now, but he won't take the title of chief of staff. He's acting chief of staff. And before that, after John Kelly, as John Kelly was leaving, Nick Ayers, who was the vice president's chief of staff, was supposed to take over the job, and in fact he did. But he started on a Wednesday, as John Kelly was transitioning out, and by the Sunday he quit, and told people he just that this was all just too crazy for him.
Michael, beyond just the craziness of the guy, I'll tell you, the word I always use to describe him is weird. He's just plain weird. Even in the small things in everyday life, I can't think of an instance where he does or says anything like a normal person would. I mean, if I met him at a dinner party, I'd probably be creeped out. Why is he so weird?
Well, I recount at a dinner party, there's a dinner party described in the book where there's the discussion was
I don't exactly know what the discussion was, but it involved Viagra. And Trump suddenly said, in the middle of this discussion, said I don't need a pill to make it go up. I need a pill to make it go down. So it is always that kind of thing. It's always, you know, not just a lack of fundamental manners and a fundamentally understanding how people relate to each other in a given situation. It's a man who just believes everything revolves around him.
And it just keeps getting crazier and more interesting. I'm sure there'll be more than enough material for a third book.
As of this moment, I would say I hope not. But yeah. We will see what happens.
Well, once more, the book is called Siege, Trump Under Fire. Michael Wolff, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Michael Wolff for coming on the podcast. Order his new book, Siege, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Follow him on Twitter at Michael Wolff. Whatever struggles you're facing, from depression and anxiety to trauma and grief, BetterHelp can connect you with a professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. It's so convenient, you can schedule secure video or phone sessions, as well as chat and text with your therapist. And anything you share is completely confidential. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Kickass News listeners even get 10% off your first month with the discount code KICK. So why not get started? Simply go to betterhelp.com/kick and fill out a questionnaire to get matched with a counselor you'll love today. Again, that's betterhelp.com/kick. Be sure to subscribe to Kickass News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. And if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at KickassNewsPod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kickass News.